Well, it was somewhere around 1985, and I had freshly finished seminary and was helping plant a church in Boston. Becky and I were married, and I was working with a painter painting houses during that time. I'm not a particularly good painter, but the guy was very patient with me and trained me in painting and wallpapering and all these different things. And we were, at one point in time, wallpapering the hallway, a large hallway in a very old country club in Weston, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston. A very, very old place. We're in this dimly lit hallway because the power was off, because it needed to be off, because we were papering around junction boxes and electrical boxes and things of that sort. So I asked Carl, my boss, I said, Carl, is the power off? I'm getting ready to paper, you know, down right next to an electrical box. Is the power off? And again, lights are dim. And Carl said, of course the power's off, Bob. And so I thought, all right. So I, back in the day, you wet the wallpaper. So I soaked the wallpaper. I got up. I started at the top. I come down. And then I get to the electrical box that the front is off and there's exposed wiring. And this is an ancient electrical box. It's not a newfangled one. And so I get down there and lo and behold, the wet wallpaper and the electricity in that junction box combined to create an explosion. It wasn't a sort of explosion. It was like boom! And it knocked me back across the hallway to the other side of the hallway, bam, against the back of the wall. And then I was sitting down, I was sitting on my butt, you know, with my entire front singed like the guys in Mouse Hunt, you know, that they're in the movies, you know, I'm black all over. And I'm smoking. I mean, there's smoke coming up from it. And Carl comes running down the hall and he looks at me, he comes really close and he looks at my, you know, my blackened face with my white eyeballs. And he goes, are you okay? And I took a breath, and he knew, since he knew that I was singed but breathing, he just was like, and he just started laughing, and I caught it. I was just like, I'm alive. This is amazing, you know. And I was singed. And I've actually been told by people that know electricity that usually will kill you. But I didn't kill me. I mean, I'm here today, right? So what was interesting was that Carl and I probably laughed for 10 minutes on that. We just couldn't stop laughing. It was like, and I just kept looking at myself and with smoking. I mean, that's just a rare thing. You know, human beings don't normally smoke. And I'm smoking and we're just laughing. But it was a near-death experience for me, sort of averted, if you will. But when things in our lives go awry, when things go boom in our lives, when things don't go as we expected them to do, as when the pressure's on, the stress is on, when life is crunching in beyond us, when we're stretched beyond our max limits, what's our reaction to that? What's your reaction to that? Think for a moment. When life starts to heat up, what is your reaction to that? It could be that you might get angry. Some of us do. I mean, I've been on the road enough at Christmas time that it seems like everybody is really impatient and everybody wants to get somewhere. And at Temecula, there are, I don't know, 10 more cars in every place, in every lane than there should be at any one point in time. Maybe there's 1,000 more cars. And people get upset. People get stressed. They withdraw. They tense up. They get touchy. Other ones I've seen and I've noticed, instead of getting all those things, they start laughing. And they don't take themselves so seriously. They actually are able to laugh it off. The reality is that when life begins to heat up around you and me, we have a choice in terms of how we're going to respond or react to that. We can respond tensely and touchily. We can respond joyfully and with laughter. And really, that is a choice. Now, I'm not saying that it's easy, but it is a choice. And I think that most of the time when life heats up, we don't see that joy is actually on the table as even an option. But I want to say to you this morning that it is, and that it always is. Joy is always an option for you, no matter what you're going through. Now, we've been looking at these early Christians, these first Christians, and how they handled this hostile environment, this stressed-out environment where they were, and we've been gleaning on what they experienced in order to maybe grab some things that we can apply as our society begins to heat up against us. And it is heating up against people of faith. That's for certain. So how is it that we, like them, can flourish? How can we choose joy like they did? Because they actually were able to experience outrageous joy in the midst of incredible trial. And as you go throughout the world with people and spend time with people who have much less than we do, many of them have nothing, and you see on them a radiance and a joy in the midst of the things that they're going through that we simply in America don't have very often. Part of it is because we have so much that we get really bothered when we have less. But the reality is that your joy quotient is not dependent on what you have or what you don't have. It's dependent on a series of other different kinds of dependencies that I want to talk to you about this morning. And so this morning, our main idea basically in looking at the same passage in the book of Acts, and it's our second to the last visit to this passage, is that how can we find God's joy and enter into it in any season or circumstance that we have and that we encounter? Now, first, I think it's important if we're going to talk about joy, what is it exactly that we're talking about when we say joy? Just so that we have a working definition together. And so there's some agreement on that. Joy is a settled sense of gladness, of delight, and pleasure. A settled sense of gladness, delight, and pleasure. I like the way that Rick Warren adds some dimension to this. He says, joy is the settled assurance that God is involved in all the details of my life. It's a quiet confidence that ultimately everything is going to be all right, and a determined choice to praise God in every situation. Now, joy and happiness are different because happiness depends on happenstance or circumstance. So you have something that happens that's particularly positive and you whoop it up. But then if things are going badly, you don't whoop it up. That's happiness. It's circumstantial. Joy is more of a settled sense of gladness that permeates and that is not dependent on everything being right. In fact, you can have joy when everything is going completely wrong. So with that in mind, let's look at what the early Christians experienced. Now, and I want to say to you this morning, by way of just a caveat, that I'm not going to talk about everything that there is to say about joy, but I think that there are some things in the passage that are instructive in terms of how we can actually enter into joy in this season. I want to read to you simply one verse from Acts chapter 2. Instead of that whole section, it's verse 46, and it says this. And every day, that's every day, daily, devoting themselves to meeting with one purpose in the temple courts and breaking bread from house to house, they were eating their food with joy and simplicity of heart. Enjoying the favor of all the people is where that actually goes on from there. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. Now, I want to hit a pause button for just a second and say, as we've looked at this passage in the book of Acts, you might be thinking, gosh, Bob, we've been in this a long time. How is it that you're able to draw so much from such a small amount of verses? Well, it basically goes like this. When I go and I open up the Word of God, I simply ask a bunch of questions. The first ones are the simple ones. Who, what, when, where, why, and how? You ask those questions, and you answer those questions, and I try to simply insert myself into the text and look around and see what's going on with the people, who it is that, and so just answering those things, who are these people? Well, these are a group of people that have recently come to Christ. Now, they may be composed of a group of people who had heard Jesus preach, you know, or had been healed by him when he was still alive and on earth. But this is all on the other side of the resurrection. And so these are people who have now heard the gospel and are part of the community of faith. What? Well, what we see is we see the move of the Spirit, and we see kind of fleshed out in a very pure and innocent way the initial findings of what this group of people saw to be true to their faith. This is the initial what the movement was going to look like. And you see there a kind of pure DNA that's beautiful. It's not all that there is, but there's a pure kind of Christian faith DNA that's experienced within them. When was it? Well, it was right after Jesus died and rose again from the dead. He ascended into heaven. He said, in just a few days, the Spirit's going to come. The Spirit comes. There's a powerful move of God. Many people come to Christ, and these people are now the fruit, the offspring of that move of God. Where is it? It's in Jerusalem. So they're in the epicenter of Jewish religion, but it's really kind of a hostile place because all the Jews that killed Jesus are hostile toward them, and the Romans are hostile toward them. And in the midst of these two things, kind of, you know, kind of pressuring in from the sides, they're flourishing. The Christian movement has always flourished in the midst of hard times. Always has. I think a lot of times when people are like, gosh, what if America turns against us? It's like, well, then the faith gets purified a bit more. But the Christian faith has always flourished under pressure. Always. And Christians have, as well as the faith. Why is Luke writing this? Well, Luke is writing this because he wants us to know that this is what this looked like. This is what the Spirit did. He wants us to know what it looks like when we allow the Spirit to move with freedom and get some imagination for what that might look like. And how did it happen? Well, it happened, as Kevin Springer said, you have the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and on the heels of that, the coming of the Spirit. Boom, this mighty, powerful move of God, and people are enjoying this grace and this presence of God in a beautiful way. So again, that is just instructive to equip you to say, when you open up your Bible and you start to read, what are the questions that you ask? Who, what, when, where, why, how, and why and how are the place to start. It's pretty easy. Does that make sense? Hello? Go like this. All right, Bob, why are you doing this to us? Well, because I want you to be able to do this on your own. I don't want you to be dependent on coming to hear this every week, and this is the only meal that you have every week. That's just not our bullseye. That's not God's bullseye. He wants you to feed all the time. But it starts with asking good questions. So as we look at this passage, several things stand out to me. Actually, five things, and I had to really struggle just to cram it down into five. And now, just so that you know, most communicators want to have 3 points or 2 points, and this is five, so whatever. All right, so here we go. Several things that we glean from this about joy. Firstly, God's kind of joy is experienced in community with others. I think a lot of times we will look at this and we won't see this, and we always think that joy is just something that we experience by ourselves, and if we're not, there's something defective about us. But I would say to you that the biblical concept of joy is very much a shared thing. It's community property, that God intends to have joy shared among us, not just joy in our own heart, although that is important for you to have it. It's a fruit of the Spirit. It's still something that we encounter when we get together. The New Testament is a community book because God is a community God. Father, Son, and Spirit have always and forever existed in community, and we are a member of them now and a member of each other. So this whole idea of coming together is in a community and being enveloped in community in a community of joy is part of God's very best for you and I. Not just as, and I think that America is so privatized and so independent, but Jesus challenges that. And I think that's beautiful because the New Testament just over and over and over again is majoring in one anothering. That is that there's so much horizontal activity, not just vertical activity. This isn't just all about you and your relationship with God and going to heaven. This is about you and your relationship with God and your relationship with his family on earth. And so over and over again, the New Testament focuses in on the one another's. Love one another, serve one another, encourage one another, bear with one another. That's not what it means. It means tolerate. Accept one another, be patient with one another, etc., etc. Here's Jesus' true north. This is what sets the compass in the right direction. A new command I give you, he says. Love one another. Now, to Jews, they'd be like, well, that's not exactly new. But Jesus is saying, this is preeminent. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. So they're to take the example of the way that Jesus loved them, that he just accepted them, he poured into them, he loved them, he did correct them from time to time, but he poured his life into them. And he says, what I did for you, now you do for each other. And this is an invitation into a brand new way of life. A community life. And so it is a together kind of life. So what would that look like? Well, together, laughing is normal. It's a little weird just to laugh by yourself, isn't it? Sometimes, I mean, I've been reading from time to time, and I read something really funny, and I laugh. And if I laugh out loud, I'm like, wow, that's a little bizarre. But laughter, if you think about it, is a community event, isn't it? I mean, just getting to play on the worship team with these people and just getting to experience this music and have fun and play. We were, you know, sound checking before, you know, we got going. And I started playing the chords to Smoke on the Water. I know that that's a bad thing, but it was fun. And we were laughing and having fun playing it because joy is our property as a community. It's in community, and together where our greeting warms our hearts, where banter is exchanged. At least if you're with Tony Chernus, banter is exchanged. Jokes are told. Small victories are celebrated. All happens together. And I get the privilege each week of, after we say the final amen, I get a chance to just observe what's going on when I'm watching you interacting with each other. I see some people huddling together to pray. So one person might be crying and they're praying for each other. But I see a whole bunch of laughter and stories being shared and just good-natured, you know, fun being had. And I watch these things and I watch over and over again, week after week, where you come in empty, you leave filled. You come in sad, you leave laughing. And this is the way that it works. Joy is a community thing. It's something that we experience together. It's a shared thing. Secondly, and I don't want to ignore this, that joy comes with food. I love that. It comes with food. At least it does for me, that God's joy is experienced by sharing a meal together. We talked about this. There's something in the food, but there's something about food and joy that somehow go together, that over a meal, the walls come down. Again, stories are shared. People open up. Laughter spreads. Warmth penetrates. It may get loud. I love the way there's a fun children's movie called Zootopia, and in the movie Zootopia, they come into the DMV, and the DMV person, it's perfect, is a sloth. It's like, oh my gosh, they totally have nailed this. But they walk in and they want to ask the sloth a question, who's a worker for the DMV, and the sloth goes, hi. And there's this very slow kind of ramp up just to get to the hi. But I see that kind of dynamic with so many of you. When you come in down, you come in stressed, you come in tense, you come in sad, come in broken. But as we're together, especially as you share a meal, there's something infectious about the joy of others. There's something infectious about being together in community. It was something that Tom was talking about, that when we were in Vietnam, we shared community together. It's a place where the enemy can really needle us if we're not careful. But it's a place, because he can needle us there, it's also a place of enormous satisfaction. So we had incredible meals that we shared together. We laughed and we shared stories and we worshiped and we razzed each other and we reflected on all of these different things that we were experiencing together. Now, joy and food, they go together. Not always. You don't have to have food to have joy, but I'll tell you, it works for me. Thirdly, joy is simple. Joy is simple. Would you say that with me? Joy is simple. God's joy is simple. I think that a lot of times we overcomplicate things. We might want to manufacture it or hype it up. I think that we also have a high capacity to over-complexitize or to make things overly complex. That we think that somehow we need everything to be right and all of these different things must be right for us to have joy. It simply isn't that way. Actually, your soul experiences joy better in simplicity than it does in complexity. But again, we as Americans need to kind of take a cue from this, that you see the simplicity in these first Christians, and that simplicity was what allowed these things to flourish. And so I would say to you simply that if you have a lot of stuff, that a lot of times, and you're protecting your stuff, that's going to steal your joy. And I think that what ends up happening is frequently we think that more things will make us happy and more things don't. Think about this for a second. If more things would make you happy, then the people who have the most things would be the happiest. But they're not. If being famous would make you happy, then the people that are the most famous would be the most happy. They're not. Those with the most money, if the happiness and joy was a quotient, a factor of having the most money, then the people who have the most money would be the happiest. And yet, 100% of the time, they're not. Why? Because that's not how it works. There is a simplicity to this. And I think that at Christmas time, we can actually invest in all these things that we think will give us joy, and they're actually joy stealers. That it is actually kind of a contentment that you bring that actually makes it work. And the Apostle Paul talks about this, and I think that contentment and joy all go together. But he says this in Philippians 4. He said, I've learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. You know this passage. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned. I've learned the secret. There's a secret here of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. What's the answer? What's the secret? I can do everything. I can do all things through Him who gives me strength. So Paul says, no matter what my circumstances are, if I tie into the relationship, simply into the relationship I have with my Maker, that I have the capacity and the strength and I have the joy to meet anything head on that is coming at me. Anything. And everything. Now, joy and contentment, they work together. And I would say, as Ali Kasaza has said so well, that less is more in this. That having less actually creates some space for joy to be there. Having less complexity creates some space for joy to be there. So that's the third thing. The fourth thing is that joy, God's joy, comes as we rest in truth. Now remember, this group of people is enjoying the apostles' teaching. They're a learning community, and the apostles aren't teaching the old covenant. They're teaching them what Jesus directly taught them. So they're talking about loving one another a lot because Jesus talked about that a lot. It was the main and the plain for him. And so he talks about these things, but what ends up happening is this is a community that's rich in truth. And they're not beating each other up with the truth. They're actually helping each other agree with what's true. Now, I think that give it a little bit of time, and the early church starts to beat each other up with the truth. And again, Americans, and actually it's not unique to us as Americans, that Christians are uniquely capable of beating each other up with the truth. But that's not what Jesus is asking us to do. He's saying, let the truth find its place in you, rest in it. I love the way that he says it in John 15. Jesus said, I've told you all this. That is, love one another, that something is coming that's going to be pressure on you, but I have overcome it. He's telling you all these things, everything that Jesus has said, he said so that his joy, my joy, he says, might be in you and that your joy might be complete or full. The word there really is literally overflowing, that your joy would be overflowing. And so if you don't rest in the truth of what's really true from God about you, if you don't rest and you don't believe that God actually delights in you, joy will be elusive. If you don't agree with him in what he says and how he sees you, joy will be elusive to you. But if you agree with that, well, now something else is at work altogether. I think that some of us are working so hard for the approval of God, not knowing that you already have it. But you're working hard. God, do you notice this? God, do you notice me? Am I okay? Are we okay with you? Are we okay together, you and me? Are we all right? And he's like, I've already made this all right with you. I've already chosen the relationship I'm going to have with you. I've already chosen the disposition that I have toward you. I love you. I'm patient with you. I delight in you. This is the truth that Jesus reveals. Now, you can go back into the Old Testament and surmise all kinds of different things, but the thing that Jesus has said is the most clear, and this is the new covenant that you and I are under, is that we are under a covenant where God has overwhelmingly showed us that he loves us and that that is not negotiable, and you cannot talk him out of it. You can't hold up a litany of things and reasons why he shouldn't love you. He's already decided that he does. That's not negotiable for him. It's never on the table. And so as you and I begin to absorb and rest in and settle into that truth and agree with him, joy begins to come. Joy comes from that agreement, that resting in what's true about you and about him. It's a movie years ago that I particularly like. The musical score is extraordinary, but it's a movie called The Mission, and it's about the Jesuit movement in South America. And the Jesuits actually were a branch of the Catholic faith that actually were aggressive in church planting and in education, but they had planted churches all throughout South America. And at one point in time, and this is probably 150 years ago at least, maybe even close to 200 years ago. And in the story of this, Rodrigo is played by Robert De Niro, and he is a slave trader. And he would go into the jungles and attack villages of locals in the South American context where they were, and he would enslave them and then sell them as slaves. Eventually, he gets in a fight with his brother over a woman, and he kills his own brother, and he can't handle himself anymore out of this. He's been this heinous, greedy man, and now he's completely imploding on himself. And so a Jesuit priest actually says, you know, if you want to do a penance, that is, do you want to do something that will actually release you from this guilt, this burden of guilt that you have, then I'm willing to set this up for you. And basically the penance is that he ties up all of his armor, all of the implements associated with his slave trade in a big net, and he ties them to his shoulders, and he climbs up the mountains to the people that he enslaved. And the group of monks that are with him, it's really a big burden because he keeps on falling down. It's raining. It's all this stuff. It's so hard to bear this burden that he's got on his back. And he's carrying this giant net full of all of the burdens of his sins of the past. Finally, he gets up cliffs and all these different things and finally gets to the place of the people who he has enslaved. And he has taken people from each one of their families and different things like that. He gets to the chief of that tribe, and he's standing there with the monks and the chief, and a man comes, one of the warriors comes with a knife and comes up and holds the knife in front of him and then goes around the side of him and saws off the burden and pushes it off the cliff and into the sea, into the water. And De Niro, Rodrigo, disintegrates into tears as his burdens are completely gone. He doesn't even know what to do with himself. But what ends up happening with the truth of and the demonstrative truth of his sins being forgiven, now joy begins to flourish in him. And you see how he cares for these people that have forgiven him and have welcomed him. And he's so full of joy. He's beside himself. He does everything he can to give his life away for them because he's experienced this kind of forgiveness from them. Folks, this is what's true about you. Now, some of us have been a lot more heinous sinners than others, but we've all been alienated from God because of our sin. This is what's true. Again, this is what the scriptures say. And this is what God has done for us. And the truth of that, once it gets a hold of us, it melts us and fills us with joy. But you must rest in what is true to have it take a hold of you. And so Jesus puts it, well, let me just... I'm sorry, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. That brings us to the last one. The fifth thing about God's joy from the passage is that God's joy arises from making our home in his presence and in his love. That basically saying this, that Jesus, you are now home base for me. You are the place of security and acceptance and safety for me. I rest here. Because he loved you when you weren't showing any signs of progress. So if you don't show signs of progress now, he loves you no less. I love the way that Eugene Peterson translates this in his paraphrase of John 15. Jesus said it this way, I've loved you the way my Father has loved me. So they've been watching this relationship, Father to Son, the whole time. They see this affection between Jesus and the Father. They see the Father's affection for Jesus at Jesus' baptism. They see this dynamic that is so beautiful and so simple and so wonderful and joyous that they share all the time. The disciples have watched this. Jesus has taught them to pray within this context. They've been watching, and so he says, as my Father has loved me, I have loved you the way that my Father has loved me. Make yourselves at home in my love. Would you read that last line with me? Make yourselves at home in my love. One more time. Make yourselves at home in my love. The word there is abide. Abide in my love, but Eugene has nailed it. That's exactly what's being said here. And abide is a little cryptic. So you sit down. And you bed down in that love. You put your full weight on him and his love. You eat and drink his love. You rest in his love. Big sigh. You rest. You cooperate. You agree. When was the last time you actually just sat there in the Lord's love and rested in it, made your home there? This is something that the Lord is inviting you and me to do today. Perhaps it's abstaining from a lot of activity. Maybe it's a series of big sighs that just let go of everything that you're carrying. Peter, an eyewitness of Jesus' resurrection and one of his disciples, he wrote, cast all your cares on him, for he cares for you. Cast your cares. I'm a hard-charging kind of a personality type. Type A, we're the ones who have heart attacks more than any other place. That's type A. That's what that means. That's where that comes from, a Framingham heart study. And in that, I hold things tightly. And I have to sit down with God and just unburden myself with him, the one who loves me, the one who accepts me, the one who's delighted in me. And I have to do that on purpose because it doesn't happen automatically. I want to ask you to do that because when you do that, joy is the back filler that the Lord uses. That's what he uses to fill you back. It's part of the fruit of the Spirit. What happens when you cooperate with the Spirit, when you yield with the Spirit, when you keep in step with the Spirit? The fruit of the Spirit starts to take its place in your life. No tree has ever produced fruit because it's strained to do so. You've never been in an orange grove and heard this orange. No, orange trees produce oranges because that's what they do. And people that are led by the Spirit produce this kind of fruit because it's what happens when you cooperate with the Spirit. You get joy and love, joy, peace, patience, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Those things come by cooperating and enjoying the presence of God, our greatest gift. So slow down. That's the net. Slow down. Get simple. Make your home in him. Make your home in him in the context of community. Eat good food. Not junk food. I don't know that joy comes with junk food. Maybe it does. No, joy does not exit in hard times. It never has. It simply is not being drawn upon. Now, I want to make a couple of last statements here. Firstly, that joy is an ecosystem, if you will. That there's, if you remove any of these things, it affects the ecosystem. So if you remove yourself from community, joy tends to dissipate. If you remove simplicity from your life and you get complex, joy tends to exit. If you remove truth and resting in your relationship with God, it's an exit ramp. You remove food, well, I don't know. Anyway, so all of these things, joy is an ecosystem, that these things all work together. And this isn't just a new list of things to do. This is the dynamic of how this works. And so God is inviting you and me to come into Jesus in a fresh way and to enjoy him in this Christmas season. To enjoy him. This all comes with Jesus. And so I ask you this morning quite simply, do you have him? And if you have him, then you have the well within you that contains all this joy. And if you don't have him, today is your day to open up your heart and have him. Here's how the Apostle John, again, one of the eyewitnesses to Jesus' resurrection, here's what he said. He said, God has given us eternal life, and this life is in his Son. Whoever has the Son has life. He who does not have God's Son does not have life. It is that simple. And so at the end of our service today, our time together, I'm going to give you a chance to either open up your heart to him and invite Jesus in, to have him, to put your trust in him today. And you might want to rededicate yourself or recommit to him as well. But I'm going to give you an opportunity to do that at the end of our service. But this joy, well, it's yours if you'll enter in. No matter what the circumstance.